You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I had to go about it, write it out, and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you.
This is the Final Word Cricket Podcast, presenting the greatest season that was, the story of the 1999 Men's World Cup. To this point, you've heard from plenty of players as we've returned to this sensational tournament a quarter of a century later. Alex Stewart, Jeff Allett and Andy Flower, to name a few. We also featured esteemed broadcaster Harsha Bogley, who was there in England on telly, documenting the journey of the Indian team. For Australia, the side who would go on to win it, they also had a broadcaster with them throughout the 7 weeks, Tim Lane. A legend of the industry, one of the finest all-round commentators the country has ever known. Back in 99, Tim was behind the mic with the BBC's Test Match Special, simulcast into Australia via the ABC. When we were originally making this series, we realised that it would be essential to get his perspective, and Dan Brennick did a fine job of doing just that. We think you'll find Tim's insights a great counterpoint to the views of the players. Before getting into the chat, a quick nod to our mates at NordVPN. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. Access everything you have at home while travelling with NordVPN. Secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you want to go. They've got over 6,000 servers in 61 countries. Find one of their nearby servers for the best VPN speeds. And to get a discount on your NordVPN plan, all you need to do is go to nordvpn.com/TFW. There's no risk associated, a 30-day money-back guarantee, and of course you'll help support the podcast as well. That link's in the show notes, nordvpn.com/TFW, 30-day money-back guarantee. All right, get comfortable. Into the time machine we go, back to the best World Cup there ever was, over to Dan Brennick with Tim Lane, chatting all things 99.
I don't believe it. That's unbelievable. Banji, he's out. Peter Will has decided that's LBW. And a remarkable win by Zimbabwe.
Saurav Ganguly just waiting on that long enough to place it away from Jonty Rhodes.
It's out. What a catch. Mark Waugh takes the catch. He just got it away.
Who is that?
Flash, that could be four. That's it. Like a rocket. That's four.
Okay.
expectations for English cricket, already receding towards the back of the national sporting consciousness, could be grave indeed.
Very sad to do an interview as we are now. This is hurting like a sting, I can promise you.
Make a case for the fact that he probably caught that.
Probably not.
So, Tim, you're over in England for the 99 World Cup, and Australia's win these days, you know, looks like it makes sense as a part of a great era for Australian cricket, but it was not an inevitable triumph, and it was also one out of a bit of chaos in that the Australian team was not necessarily the happiest through that tournament, and that was something that a story essentially that you'd broken earlier in the tournament.
Yes, I suppose it's a bit hard all these years on to recall how I saw Australia's trajectory and prospects, but the fact that we'd lost the final 4 years earlier, somewhat unexpectedly to Sri Lanka. There was, I think, logically, and memory does suggest this, you know, a feeling of it's time to put things right, and it's time we won a second World Cup. Steve Waugh was the captain of the limited over team and had been for some time, but had only at the end of January that year, with the retirement of Tubby Taylor, become captain of the Test team. So, you know, was now in control, and he'd been injured late in the second block of World Series matches in that Australian summer, and Shane Warne had captained the team, and this was in the lead up to an appointment being made in relation to the Test captaincy, and Warne was clearly relishing being in charge, and he was sort of bringing a flamboyance to it that you don't associate with Steve Waugh, and I suppose he was presenting a point of difference, and the team was responding and playing well under him, and so it felt a little bit like an election campaign, and as it turned out, he didn't win the election, and Waugh was captain of the Test team that went to the West Indies, and of course that didn't go according to plan. Lara batted the lights out, and Australia were in trouble in that series and eventually had to scramble to all. So Waugh hadn't got off on the right foot, and then there was only a very small window between that and the World Cup. So it was a difficult period, I think, for the team, but particularly for the skipper. And then it didn't start terribly well. There was a lacklustre win over Scotland. And I remember Peter Roebuck, ever perceptive, observing to me that the team looked flat, and I was sort of assuming they were just going along at half pace and, you know, doing enough to win it. But he saw something else. And then they played New Zealand in Cardiff and were beaten pretty decisively, and then faced a match against Pakistan at Leeds. And it was in between those games that a couple of conversations I had suggested to me that perhaps flowing out of the West Indies, where Warne had been dropped for the final test, that all wasn't well. I suspect it might also have been related to the way the team had responded to him in that latter part of the Australian summer. In fact, one view of it, as expressed to me, was that the younger players in the team might have been a little uncertain as to who they wanted to be leading them. I'm not sure as to the accuracy of that, but that was put to me at that time. But it was suggested that there was some sort of leadership crisis, if you could put it that way. And I sent back within a 24-hour period for Grandstand and just reporting on the World Cup in chats with Karen Tai, two reports in which I signalled that. The first I'd done on the Friday night in Leeds, and then the second I'd done at breakfast time the next morning, which was sort of late in the day in Australia. And I think I've got the chronology right, perhaps not. And then I headed out to training at Headingley on this freezing Saturday morning. I'd heard that most of the journos were having a day off, and I thought naively that I might have a chance to just sort of buttonhole Steve Waugh quietly and put to him what I'd heard, hopefully get an interview with him and see where it all led. But by the time I got to the ground, it was crawling with Australian journalists because news of what I'd already sent back had emerged. And then Steve, who seemed in very good spirits, volunteered to come over and do his, you know, media interview straight away. And so any chance I had of a private chat was gone. And then the issue of leadership was the first one raised. He knew none of this. He was blindsided by it and went ballistic and demanded to know who was responsible. And I put up my hand and I was told I wouldn't be welcome at any further press conferences that he gave during the World Cup. And, of course, there was a furious denial. He called Warnie over to stand next to him and support him. And that was it. I mean, I was on the nose. I suppose for a moment I had that sense that I'm sure plenty of journalists have had over the years, because this kind of territory is not my natural terrain.
Commentating more so than reporting.
Well, yeah, but this was sort of, there was suddenly a feeling of, God, I hope I've got this right. but I think with hindsight, I did have it right.
Steve, I said, no, I'm the captain of this side. I'm the captain, you're not playing. So I was really disappointed. After 10 years, I just had a shoulder up, and I thought the situation going where we have to win the Test match would have brought the best out of me too.
You've never got over that, have you?
No, I just, I don't like, I mean, I don't like Steve Waugh for a lot of other reasons, yeah, but yeah, that was sort of the reason I thought.
And I've been told that by people within the party as the years have passed. But I think that, you know, there's always been a certain reluctance to go into all the gory detail of it. But it was a fascinating time, and the ice thawed as the next 5 weeks played out. But there was a bit of thawing to do before we got there.
One person, I think, certainly having conversations with him, who was important in that thawing generally, both within the team and perhaps also the team and people outside the team, was Tom Moody as a senior figure and, you know, not a titled leader in the team, but someone who'd been around for a long time and had been a captain of a lot of teams. And I think what was certainly happening was that Steve Waugh was trying to work out himself how to be a captain and how disciplined to be with the team. I think he thought that he'd been too lax in the West Indies and tried to tighten it up in England, but then probably went too far the other way. So, yeah, there was a lot of, I think, him just trying to work out where he stood with the team, and probably the crucible of a World Cup was, you know, it made it a pretty urgent matter.
And there was the matter of a curfew that was imposed as part of that, and that hadn't gone down too well, so it probably wasn't what he needed at that time. Anyway, it played out as it did, and perhaps, and I would never claim that it was the trigger for the rethink that turned Australia's fortunes around, but it did coincide at least, and, you know, it might have been a factor. And I suspect from one part of what happened that it mightn't have been entirely unpopular. I mean, sometimes you sense a little bit of encouragement to do a story and be the mug who puts his head into the lion's jaw. And unwittingly, I think I had done that. I think there was also just another little anecdotal piece is that before the game in Durham, I think it was, against Bangladesh, I'd done an interview with one player, and I won't name him, but I'd done a straightforward match preview, how's your form, and that sort of thing type interview. And back at the hotel, maybe into the evening, he approached me and asked, could he have a listen to the interview? And we went to my room and I played it back to him. And I did wonder, with hindsight, as to whether he'd only become abreast of what had been transpiring over the previous few days and wanted to make sure that there hadn't been any landmines laid in the interview, and was wanting to make sure that it was all okay. But it is indicative that there was some apprehension within the ranks.
As you say, they lose to Pakistan, but it's an improved performance, and they then start on their run of wins that they have to get to first the Super Sixes and then obviously the semi-finals. Now, the game at Leeds against South Africa, you know, in we're talking about the semi-final, but in many ways this is a two-act play of those two matches. But what were your impressions of, I suppose, Australia's chase and what they took out of Leeds going into Manchester?
Yeah, well, it was an amazing day. What South Africa said, Australia 274 or 5 or something, at a time when that was a pretty big score, big chase. And I remember Darren Lehman, who was injured in
He was injured, Damien Martin was playing.
Yeah, and he somehow had been up in the sort of the grandstand in the environs of the BBC's commentary box there, and I remember him saying to me that, you know, he felt this pitch was a bit up and down and that that was a serious chase. So it didn't sound terribly optimistic, and then I think we were 3 for 48 and really it looked close to all over. And then Steve Waugh just played what I've always regarded as the best innings I ever saw him play. Very difficult to make comparisons between Test and ODI or 2020 innings. But, you know, this was a real tightrope walking act in a way that Test cricket wasn't. And so it was less familiar to him because he had to survive. Well, he was good at that. We knew that. But he also had to keep the runs coming. He managed to do both.
He'll come back for a second. And Steve Waugh completes only his second century in more than 270 limited over internationals. He has chosen precisely the moment for a masterpiece of an innings.
It was, you know, it was a survival act that was also productive. It was a masterpiece, I think. And love to hear his thoughts. I've never asked him that, but I'd imagine it would sort of be right there with the most satisfying for every reason, because he now, you know, he played the hand that, well, it was only his second or third ODI century.
Second.
So, you know, it was an innings the like of which he'd never really had to play in this form of the game. And in those circumstances where there was no tomorrow, if he couldn't pull it off and the team couldn't pull it off, well, and he was stuffed, because I think he had indicated, or Trevor Holmes might have indicated as chairman of selectors, that it was highly unlikely that Waugh would continue as the ODI captain if the team didn't make the semi-finals. And this was all about making the semi-finals. It was semi-finals or bust, and it was huge, and it had to have given him and the team enormous confidence. But nevertheless, we knew at that time that South Africa were a really tough opponent in that form of the game. They still were looking for their first World Cup, still are. They were the team to beat. They played really solidly throughout. So I think maybe it had the effect of taking the two teams to Edgbaston, like even money each of two, because we knew the South Africans would still be very hard to beat. They had a cushion going into that semi-final, but of course the outcome was crucial in that it elevated Australia ahead of the Proteas in the event, unlikely as it was, that the semi was a tie.
One more thing about that Super 6 game, obviously, was the Herschel Gibbs catch. Now, were you on the air at the time?
No, I wasn't. Okay. I don't believe I was. In fact, I think I was sitting in the back of the box.
Okay. How did you read it, watching it? I suppose people talk about it relative to what the laws were and what Gibbs's habits had been as a celebrator, or somewhat premature celebrator of catches.
I've got a horrible feeling I might have had my head down, you know, looking at my notes or something. At that moment, I seem to recall that I didn't see it in the moment, and I've scarcely seen it back, to be honest. And I think I heard the commentary and sort of looked up to try and work out what had happened. It was one of those things, I guess, needed to be looked at and studied. Well, oh, I don't know. I mean, the Warn thing, I certainly wasn't aware of any... Yeah, as an observer, that if Gibbs took a catch, you'd need to make sure he had actually completed it. That had never occurred to me. It might have occurred to others, and apparently it had occurred to Warnie that this was something to keep a bit of an eye on. But no, it was, you know, it was out of the blue, and it was extraordinary in any cricket match at that stage of a big tournament, even more so. And I don't really know what to make of it. Mm. But, you know, there were aspects. I'm not meaning to suggest anything, but, you know, there were aspects of South Africa at that time with Hansi Cronje as captain, which, viewed in hindsight, you could believe anything. As it was, you know, he did drop the World Cup.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Ebony Rainford-Brent, and you're listening to The Final Word.
We get to the semi-final. Now, you told me already about, I suppose, the day dawning and, you know, this very salubrious accommodation, you know, TMS style you were in, and then the rush to get to the ground. So just talk me through that.
Yeah, well, Peter Baxter, the TMS producer, with whom I'd become good friends, had invited me to join their group. I think I'd been in town a day or two earlier and had been staying in just an average hotel, motel. And Peter said, why don't you come out and stay with us at Brockencote? And Brockencote Hall, I discovered, was this glorious, you know, retreat out beyond the city limits. And on the morning of the match, I woke to the baaing of sheep in the paddocks that surrounded Brockencote. I had dinner and a drink with the TMS team the night before, and it was a glorious setting. And I learnt that was their regular digs when they were doing test matches or other major games in or outside Birmingham. There I was getting a taste of that, and it was memorable enough for that, but sort of that got lost over the 24 hours that followed. I had to, as you do, I had a car and had to navigate my way to the ground, and through building traffic, I got there in reasonable time for the start of the match. But not everyone was so lucky, and Peter Baxter told me that as he was sort of putting the finishing touches to having everything set up for the broadcast, he began to get a bit edgy, and he got a call from Aggers, who was his chief commentator, to say that he was stuck in traffic and he mightn't be there for the start of the broadcast and the preview. And so Peter thought, well, at least I've got Gerald de Kock from South Africa and Tim. And a couple of minutes away from the broadcast opening, he looked for the two of us, and he saw Gerald with a phone in one ear talking to South Africa and me with a phone in one ear talking to Australia. So Peter had to go on the air and start the broadcast himself. Gerald and I, quickly off our domestic commitments, and were able to join in, and then Aggers, I think, was there for the start of the match. But the stage had been set. There was tremendous expectation after what had happened just those few days earlier. And, of course, Lords in the final was on the end of it.
In the lead-up, Steve Waugh sought to heighten any psychological advantage that Australia had gained by making frequent references to the Gibbs dropped catch.
So there was just a wonderful feeling of build-up and of expectancy about what might happen. And, of course, we couldn't have imagined, and didn't dare to imagine, that there could be a repeat of what had happened in Leeds. That was almost too good to be true, and things like that don't happen twice, do they?
Well, the tension and the expectation around the ground, I mean, it looks early on in the game as though, you know, South Africa, having messed up at Leeds, are completely in control of this one. And even after Steve Waugh and Michael Bevan have their partnership to retrieve things somewhat, give Australia something to bowl at, the tail gets knocked over very quickly, and it's the sense that, well, this is probably not quite the score that's going to get it done on this surface.
Yes, it did look that way. It was probably a pitch on which, you know, it was hard to stay in, to be in for an extended period, and runs, you know, were never really flowing. But when Kirsten and Gibbs got away to the start that they did, I mean, it looked to be almost all over by the shouting. And then enter Warne, three wickets in a couple of overs, one of them Cronje lucky to get. You know, the value or the importance of that only grew in hindsight. caught off his foot. He only needed to score one run, and it could have been a different story. But on it went, and it did ebb and flow. Australia had moments of getting back into it, and then there'd always be that partnership that seemed to put it back in South Africa's hands again. But of course, these were just the preliminaries, because we were building to a final act that, you know, no one would have dared imagine could happen.
The worn ball to Gibbs. I mean, I remember as a kid at home in Adelaide, Mum and Dad basically made the executive decision, okay, it's time to go to bed. And it was 40 for none when I went to bed. But I had a clock radio and I turned it on after the light had gone out and heard, didn't hear Gibbs getting bowled, but heard, I think Vic Marks was on summarising his reaction to it. You know, talking very much about, you know, this pitch is spinning big and, you know, this changes the whole complexion of the game. And I'm not quite, you know, in half going to sleep, not quite knowing what had happened. But is that how it felt at the ground? You know, that ball did change not only, obviously, the scoreboard in terms of a wicket falling, but change the attitude of both sides.
I guess so. I mean, but it was only one wicket and there was still a long way to go. But it was a taste of Warne and his genius. And he was getting his mojo back, because post-West Indies and post, you know, whatever else went on during that World Cup, he had been struggling. And in fact, late in the piece, but certainly prior to the match at Leeds against South Africa, I remember Steve Waugh going into bat for him at a press conference about form and just about where he was at, because he really, I think, had been doing it hard. And just all the detail of that I can't give you, but he was down, I think, which wasn't familiar territory for him. But now he bounced back. You know, suddenly he was that kind of football captain on the ground, really, you know, giving off energy to his teammates. And that wicket certainly had that impact. And a couple of wickets later, everyone was starting to believe again.
Fast forward to the closing moments of the game. So when do you actually take the microphone?
Well, there's a story in that. A little earlier on, incidentally, and you know, everyone's heard the TMS team talking about chocolate cakes and red wine, and the red wine is largely a legacy of the Arlott era, when he drank most of it. But it wasn't unusual, I found, for the cork to be pulled out of a nice French red during the box at some stage, particularly late in the piece, towards the end of a day or the end of a match. And that day, Shilpa Patel, a very vivacious assistant to Peter Baxter, had opened a red fairly late in the piece, and she was about to pour me a glass, and I said, just hold off, Shilps. I just think I'd better wait until this one's done. And it was a sixth sense, because, you know, I do like a glass of wine, and this game looked to be pretty well over at that stage. I think I'm trying to remember which, because there were so many changes.
During the Callis and Rhodes partnership?
Yeah, it probably was, yeah. And I was ever so thankful for a rare moment of temperance and good judgment later on, because what had happened was that I was on the air. Gerald de Kock had been on, and Peter Baxter tried to have the commentator from the winning nation at the microphone as the match ended, and had been doing that, I think, through the World Cups over the years, and managing to organise it with great success. And Gerald was on until Steve Elworthy was run out, McGrath knocking the ball onto the stumps, a review and all of that. And Gerald then threw to me, because it looked as though Australia were home. What, 16 to win, 8 balls left, 1 wicket in hand, was an equation heavily slanted the bowling team's way. But of course it reckoned without Klusner.
And arguably the first time all day that Australia had definitively been in front in the game.
Yep, that'd be fair. Klusner hits the 6th that Paul Rifle drops overhead down at, what was it, Long On? And then scores a single. And now it's 9 to win, with an over in which to get them. And he has been in irresistible form. And he smashes the first 2 balls for 4. And I literally looked around for Gerald. May have even said on the air, you know, where's Gerald de Kock? Because he better come in to polish this one off.
Well, it's Damien Fleming who's got the privilege or the nightmare of bowling this last over.
And feeling a little crestfallen, I might add. Gerald had left the box. Someone suggested he might have headed off to sort of go over the back of the grandstand or something, in jest, of course. But it looked like, you know, another disappointment for South Africa when he came off the air. Now it looks as though they've got it won. So I'm there, and it looks as though I'm the one who will be calling the South African victory.
Those two boundaries off Damien Fleming, I mean, I think he's said numerous times that their idea was inclusion was strong on the leg side. They were going to bowl wide Yorkers outside off stump, and they were hit so hard that the boundary riders, I think it was Mark Warren, Tom Moody at point and long off, barely had the chance to move.
Yeah, they were amazingly powerful shots, and of course the smallness of English cricket grounds magnifies that. When I've seen them back, I've thought, my God, you know, that would have gone to another boundary as far back from the square. So hard had he hit the ball. There was no chase. Once it was through and the placement had been executed to perfection, well, you know, there was no point even bothering. It was at the boundary before anyone could take two or three steps.
From your commentary perch, I mean, what did you notice, or what were you describing between the, I suppose, the second and the third ball, Steve Waugh bringing the field in, that sort of thing?
Hard to remember all the detail. I need to go back and have a listen. But there was the fact that Fleming came over the wicket at that point. Yes, I remember Vic commenting on the fact that the field was up and, you know, there's absolutely no point them not being all up now.
Were you clear on the tie getting Australia through?
I was, yeah. I had checked that out and I can't remember. I think I'd probably done it pre-match, but never thinking that it would come to that. In fact, after it ended and we were now into sort of coming down a little bit and trying to make sense of all that had happened, and, you know, it wasn't easy to make sense of what the Klusner and Donald had done to each other during those two deliveries, the first of which, you know, nearly ran Donald out and Lehman missed. But I remember seeing, I think, Des Rundle, who was a board member at that time, and one or two other Cricket Australia figures sitting in the front row. So we were at the back in the commentary box, and then I can't remember how many rows of seats there were, but not that many. And they were sort of on the balcony edge. And I recall them turning around, looking beseechingly at me for confirmation that this put Australia into the final. Because I remember having one of those moments of, my God, I hope I've got this right. But in fact, what didn't immediately occur to me was that the Australians had been celebrating pretty hard when they'd achieved that final wicket. So there was no doubt about it. And yeah, Australia had, what was it, gone ahead on net run rate and achieved, you know, out of that victory in Leeds. So it was costly to South Africa in a bigger way than they would have thought possible. And having been the form team of the tournament, they now found themselves the lower rated in that match. So, yes, and in fact, I think in my commentary, with scores level and Fleming about to bowl one of those two deliveries, the third and fourth of the over, I had said that a tie would put Australia in the final. So I was clear on that. I certainly had that one under control.
A wicket in hand, and a wicket would put Australia in the final. A tie would have Australia in. South Africa need to win it. They're all up now. There are a couple of slips. They're all in the circle.
And Darren Lehman, of course, had a free hit at the stumps, basically, with Donald backing up too quickly from the third ball. Did the TMS box share the general consensus at the ground that, well, that was Australia's only chance?
Well, I think that was the feeling, yeah. And I remember Vic Marks watching the replay from side on, because we weren't seeing it from side on, and having it confirmed that, you know, it's one of those things, you, as it happens, you think, well, that would have been close. He might have been out. And then you see it from side on and you realise, well, he would have been out by away. And, yes, it's sort of amid the drama, it was as though, yeah, OK, that's done. Now we move on very quickly. He's about to come in and bowl again. But it did certainly feel as though, well, you you can't get a second chance, something like that. And now there was one ball still to be, well, there were three balls to be bowled, but here comes the next one.
And that's really the setup for the final ball, because there's unquestionably an influence on Alan Donald from the third ball in what occurs on the fourth ball, and that's critical to the whole drama.
Yes, I guess, you know, this has probably been a little bit underestimated. Looking back at it recently, as I did, he was in a difficult situation in that Mark Waugh had seized upon that ball and wasn't far from the stumps. He wasn't far back. And he, you know, he backhanded it as only he could do, except he just missed. So I suppose Donald was in that situation where he didn't want to find himself backing up wholeheartedly and sort of going to the point of no return, just in case something like that happened. And so he was sort of in two man's land. And I think he I don't know whether he'd left his crease, but not by much. But he sort of hovered there, and Klusner really was the one who was now at fault, because he kept coming, and finally Donald just had to go, but he had no hope because Flem had done his 10-pin bowling practice during the week, and he was underarming the ball down to Gilly behind the stumps.
And I suppose as well it was a tribute to the fielding quality of Mark Waugh that he, just by his presence, could create that indecision between two batsmen.
Yep. And just did it so quickly and neatly and clinically, and then the underarm down the pitch, of course, is etched into Australian cricketing folklore.
Oh! It's a tie! Australia is in the final! Australia is in a fourth, an unprecedented fourth World Cup final after an unbelievable tie at Edgbaston. Incredible, impossible to describe mix-up. South Africa all out, 213. The match is tied, and Australia go to Lords and the final.
I think people still ask, why the hell did he do that?
Of all of the moments in cricket that you had commentated on, and I know we spoke a few years ago about the Port Elizabeth Test match in 97. It was one of the most memorable ones. Where does it sit?
It sits way above any other moment. It was unbelievable. The head-spinning nature of it. I remember going down to the rooms with a tape recorder, and I interviewed Flem and I interviewed Steve Waugh. And I remember Steve Waugh saying to me in that interview, and I think he used the, whatever you call it, the pronoun one. One almost needs a stiff drink after that.
Steve Waugh was looking for something to calm his nerves after this.
Yeah, I mean, the first 10 minutes in the dressing room, you sort of sit there and the adrenaline's pumping that much. It's a strange feeling. I mean, you're excited, but you're tired, and you know, your heart's jumping out of your chest still, and you know, you need a drink to settle down almost.
He didn't say it laughing. I think it was as though he had been so through the ringer on that day, and I suppose for 6 weeks leading up to it, that he probably did feel he needed a stiff drink at the end of it. And even being there as an observer, but one with a professional role and wanting to make the most of it and you know, to get the job done faithfully and effectively, it was a head spinner. And I was a kid when the Brisbane tie played out. It was the first test I'd really listened to almost in its entirety. No TV in those days. And, you know, just under, what, how many, 40 years later, to find myself in a different form of the game and all of that, but to be broadcasting a game that finished in the same result as that game in Brisbane, it was a sense of completion in that, I suppose, in some ways. Not that I was thinking about that at the time, but when I reflect on it, there was. As I say, I had to go and do interviews and then file voice pieces and so on for news bulletins on morning radio in Australia. So that was the busiest time of those days. And, you know, it was a great sense of excitement, I suppose, particularly when the I'm an Australian and Australia had won the match. So to be able to go down to the rooms and talk to people is a privilege and a thrill in moments like that. Somehow, along the way, I'd bumped into a colleague from the ABC in Melbourne, Rob Clancy, who was a young journo in the newsroom here in Melbourne, and he loved sport and was travelling in England and watching some World Cup cricket and was at that match. And he said, "Can I give you a hand with anything?" And I sort of almost fell at his feet weeping because I needed a hand. And he came and did some of the work for me. And once we got it all done, it enabled me to get it done a bit quicker. And like Steve Waugh, I was in need of a stiff drink, but I also had to drive back to London because I wasn't staying that night in Birmingham, and my accommodation was for London that night. I said to Rob, what are you doing? Where are you headed? You know, could have been going to Scotland or Ireland or France for all I knew. And he said, I've got to get to London. And I said, oh, mate, jump in with me. I just want someone to be with and to talk to. And so he got in and we, you know, had a terrific drive through the evening. You know, night had fallen. And we pulled up at some stage, I think, to get a coffee and a sandwich or something, and sort of down the chute into one of those sort of big service station supermarket type joints. And I think I got a call from ABC Radio, Breakfast Radio in Sydney. Philip Clark was doing the show in those days. He wanted to have a chat about it because it was obviously the story of the morning in the early hours in Australia. So I gladly sat there sort of in the darkness chatting with him, and I do remember him saying to me towards the end of the interview, have you heard it back? Have you heard the last couple of balls replayed? And I said, no, I haven't had a chance to. Hadn't really given it a moment's thought, but I was hoping, just hoped it turned out all right. And he said, well, let's have a listen. And he played it to me. So there I was, somewhere between Birmingham and London, with a mobile phone next to the ear, hearing the broadcast from whatever it was, three, 4 hours earlier.
And what time would it have been when you finally got the glass of red you forsworn?
I seem to recall we were staying in that sort of high-rise hotel up near Lords, just over the road. I think it was a Hilton in those days. And my daughter, who had turned 20 only a few weeks earlier, had been travelling. She was having a gap year from her studies and had been travelling on mainland Europe. And she'd just been to Ireland and was coming back. And she was arriving and we were meeting. That was part of the reason I needed to be there that evening. And so we met in the bar, I think, at probably 10:30 at night or 11 o'clock or something like that. And can't remember what I drank, but I can imagine it tasted pretty good.
14 or 15 hours of absolutely riveting drama have led to this, a tied match, and Australia going into the final as a result.